The opinions expressed on this program do not reflect the views and opinions of Audio Journal, its board of directors, staff, or volunteer readers. Thank you for listening to Audio Journal.
Hello and welcome to Audio Journal's Mindful Moments program. You'll hear articles today from the Spirit of Change magazine. I'm Mary Lou Quinlan, and for the next half hour, we'll explore how to take care of your bones, the placebo effect, and how not to help. The placebo effect can work as well as real medicine, but your body may need permission to use it. The strangest part of the placebo effect is not that it works, it's what makes it work. Published May 4th, 2026 by Phil Starks of The Conversation. The first time the placebo effect really got under my skin was when I read that roughly one-third of people with irritable bowel syndrome improve on placebo treatments alone. Usually this statistic is presented as a fascinating quirk of medicine. My reaction was anger. Humanity possesses an extremely effective treatment with essentially zero side effects, and patients need someone else's permission to use it. The placebo effect refers to the improvements in symptoms that patients experience after they're given an inert treatment like a sugar pill. Driven by expectation, context, and social cues rather than pharmacology, the placebo effect is often dismissed as all in the mind, but decades of research have shown it is anything but imaginary. Placebo treatments can trigger measurable changes in the brain, immune system, and hormone function. In studies on pain, placebos cause the brain to release endorphins, the body's natural opioids. In Parkinson's disease, placebo injections increase dopamine activity in the brain. The placebo effect isn't magic, it's biology. Having spent nearly a quarter of a century teaching evolutionary medicine, I've come to see placebos not as curiosities of clinical trials, but as windows into how human biology responds to social signals. And it's that relationship that is exactly what makes the placebo effect unsettling. Medicine works, even when it isn't medicine. The placebo effect is so reliable that researchers must account for it in nearly every clinical trial. When testing a new drug, scientists compare its effects to what patients experience on a placebo treatment like sugar pills, saline injections, or sham surgery. If the drug doesn't outperform the placebo, it rarely reaches the public. Placebo responses are common and powerful enough to rival active treatments. Even surgery isn't immune to the placebo effect. In several well-documented studies of knee procedures, patients who receive sham operations, incisions without the full surgical repair, improved almost as much as those who received the real procedure. Clearly something real is happening inside the body. But the strangest part of the placebo effect is not that it works, it's what makes it work. The prescription of belief. Placebo treatments tend to be more effective when delivered by credible authorities. Pills work better when prescribed by doctors wearing white coats. Expensive pills outperform cheap ones. Injections produce stronger responses than tablets. Some researchers have even removed the deception from placebo experiments entirely. In open-label placebo studies, patients are directly told they are receiving a placebo, and yet many still report significant improvement. But look more closely at how these studies are run. Patients are not simply handed a sugar pill and sent home. They receive an explanation from a clinician, in a medical setting, within a structured ritual of care, a context that may be doing much of the biological work. Even when the deception disappears, the social scaffolding remains. The permission to heal is still being granted by someone else. The placebo effect extends beyond the patient. The placebo effect is often framed as something happening inside an individual, but it does not operate in isolation. Consider what happens in veterinary medicine. Dogs and cats cannot believe a treatment they're given will work. They have no concept of receiving medication. Yet when owners and vets believe an animal is being treated, they consistently report improvements in pain and mobility that medical tests do not confirm. In one study of dogs with osteoarthritis, owners reported improvement roughly 57% of the time for animals receiving only a placebo. The animals themselves may not have improved, but the humans caring for them perceived they had. The healing signal, it turns out, travels through the humans in the room. When healing makes things worse. There have been times when going to the doctor made you less likely to survive. In the 19th century, mainstream medicine was built on bloodletting, purging, and doses of mercury and arsenic, treatments that killed as often as they cured. Homeopathy emerged in the late 18th century precisely in this context. Its founder, Samuel Hahnemann, was a physician horrified by the harm that conventional medicine of his time was causing. His highly diluted versions of contemporary remedies did nothing pharmacologically that could be measured, but they also did not kill people, which put them decisively ahead of the competition. Homeopathic patients not only survived, but also reported dramatic recoveries from chronic ailments and acute infections alike. During the cholera epidemics of the mid-1800s, patients at homeopathic hospitals had lower death rates than those receiving standard care. Why was that? The standard cholera treatment of the area was aggressive and exhausting for a disease that already caused massive fluid loss. Doctors often prescribed further bloodletting along with toxic purgatives such as calomel, a form of mercury, to flush the system. In contrast, homeopathic care involved extreme dilutions of substances in water or alcohol, effectively providing hydration and a calm, structured environment without the physiological assault. Were homeopathy death rates lower simply because of the placebo effect, combined with not poisoning patients, making homeopathy far more effective than the medicine of the day? Healing is not free. The body needs resources to heal from injury and disease. Activating systems such as immune responses, tissue repair, and inflammation at the wrong time can be dangerous. A full-scale immune response is metabolically expensive, with fever increasing metabolic rate by roughly 10% per degree Celsius rise in body temperature. Triggered at the wrong time, this can deplete critical energy reserves needed for immediate survival, such as escaping a predator. Furthermore, misplaced or overzealous inflammation causes collateral damage to healthy tissues, potentially leading to chronic dysfunction. Some researchers have proposed that placebo responses reflect a kind of biological health governor, a system that regulates when the body invests heavily in recovery. Cues from trusted individuals may be exactly the signal the body waits for before committing resources to recovery. A caregiver's reassurance, a physician's authority, and the rituals of medicine may tell the body that conditions are finally stable enough to devote energy to healing. If that interpretation is correct, the placebo effect is not a trick of the mind. It is an ancient biological system responding to social information. The uncomfortable implication. The placebo effect is a feature of human biology that people have largely surrendered to whoever performs authority most convincingly. If belief can activate biological healing pathways, belief can also be manipulated. Charismatic figures, elaborate medical rituals, and expensive treatments may produce real improvement in symptoms even when the underlying treatment is physiologically inert. That is how wellness culture works. It leverages the same social scaffolding of care to trigger the body's internal pharmacy, regardless of whether the treatment itself does anything. The placebo effect is often celebrated as proof that the mind can heal the body, but I believe that may not be its most interesting lesson. It also reveals that human physiology evolved to take its cues from other people. Your brain, immune system, and pain response are not isolated machines. They are deeply intertwined with social signals, expectations, and trust. In a world filled with doctors, advertisements, wellness influencers, and elaborate medical rituals, that insight is both fascinating and profoundly maddening. People are walking around with one of the most powerful healing systems ever documented locked inside them. Yet, they can most readily access it only when someone in a position of authority gives them permission. Phil Starks is a behavioral ecologist with broad interests and a particular passion for social insects. His lab has tackled questions ranging from identifying new microbial species to documenting ecological impacts of biological invasions. This article is from The Conversation, an independent nonprofit news organization dedicated to sharing the knowledge of academic experts. It was reprinted with permission on Spirit of Change. Our next article is entitled The Silent Conversation Between You and Your Bones. When we stop moving, bones interpret it as a signal that they're no longer needed and begin to fade away. published April 20th, 2026 by Tom Hartman. As my wife Louise and I have aged, we've noticed that one of the biggest challenges is keeping our posture straight and our bones from getting brittle. There's science behind this challenge, and it gives us all suggestions for keeping young. Bone is one of the few tissues in the human body that remains alive and dynamic from birth to death. It's not the rigid, inert structure most people imagine when they think of skeletons. In fact, it's constantly growing, dying, dissolving, and rebuilding itself through a delicate dance between two main kinds of cells, osteoblasts and osteoclasts. This balance is what keeps us upright, protects our organs, and allows our muscles to move us through life. But as we get older, the harmony between building and breaking begins to shift, and the results can be devastating. Understanding how that process happens and how we might slow or reverse it is one of the quiet frontiers of aging science. Bone is built primarily by osteoblasts, the construction workers of our skeleton. They take raw materials, calcium, phosphate, and collagen, and create new bone matrix. This matrix starts out soft like scaffolding, then mineralizes into the hard tissue we recognize as bone. Opposing them are osteoclasts, which act more like demolition crews. They dissolve old or damaged bone so it can be replaced. In a healthy adult, these two systems are in balance. Every bit of bone that's broken down is replaced by new bone. But that balance depends on a complex interplay of hormones, mechanical stress, and nutrients that becomes harder to maintain with age. Our bones thrive on impact. When we're young, our bodies prioritize growth and repair. Hormones like growth hormone, estrogen, and testosterone are all signal that bone-building cells stay active and reproduce. Even the act of moving, walking, climbing stairs, carrying groceries, tells our bones to stay strong. Osteoblasts thrive on impact. They literally sense mechanical stress and respond by building more bone where it's needed. That's why astronauts lose bone density in zero gravity, and bedridden patients lose it quickly in immobilized limbs. Bones are designed for stress. They grow from it, adapt to it, and depend on it. But aging quietly changes the equation. By the time most people reach their 40s or 50s, osteoblasts start slowing down while osteoclasts keep right on working. Estrogen and testosterone, which protect against bone loss, begin to drop. In women, the sharp decline in estrogen during menopause often leads to an acceleration of bone loss so dramatic it can reach 1 to 2% per year. The result is a net thinning of the bones that can culminate in osteopenia or osteoporosis. What's more, osteoblasts themselves become less responsive to mechanical stress and less efficient at mineralizing new bone, while their numbers dwindle with each passing decade. How we can regenerate bone. Yet there's another layer to this story that is both hopeful and cautionary. Bone cells are not fixed in number. They arise from progenitor cells, stem-like precursors in the bone marrow and periosteum, the thin tissue surrounding bones. These progenitor cells can, under the right conditions, become new osteoblasts. Exercise, especially high-impact weight-bearing exercise, stimulates their differentiation. Nutrients like vitamin D, calcium, and magnesium fuel the process. Even exposure to sunlight, through its effect on vitamin D synthesis, plays a critical role in signaling these cells to mature. In a very real sense, every step we take outdoors in the sunshine is a small act of bone regeneration. On the other hand, disuse and a sedentary lifestyle send the opposite message. When bones aren't stressed, the progenitor cells shift toward becoming fat cells instead of bone cells, and osteoclasts take over the stage. This explains why modern sedentary living, coupled with diets low in essential minerals, has created an epidemic of bone fragility, even among people who think of themselves as healthy. It also explains why impact, whether from walking, jumping, or resistance training, isn't just good for muscle tone. It's a direct message to your bones to stay alive. The most effective bone-building tools we possess are natural. There's a growing body of research exploring how bone regeneration might be enhanced as we age. Some of it focuses on pharmacological ways to stimulate osteoblast activity or block osteoclast overactivity, like the bisphosphonate drugs or parathyroid hormone analogs now used for osteoporosis. Others look at stem cell therapies that could replenish the aging pool of bone-forming cells. But many of the most effective tools we already possess are natural. Regular resistance training, adequate protein intake, and maintaining proper levels of vitamin D and K2 can have profound effects on bone density. The simple act of impact, bones striking the ground, muscles tugging on tendons, joints bearing weight, remains the single most powerful way to keep bones young. The idea that bone knows when it's being used and responds accordingly is one of nature's most elegant feedback loops. It means that our skeleton is not a fixed thing, but a living organ that senses and adapts to our behavior. When we stop moving, bones interpret it as a signal that they're no longer needed and begin to fade away. When we challenge them, they thicken, harden, and renew themselves. Even in old age, this feedback loop can be reawakened, though the gains are slower and more fragile than in youth. In the larger metaphor of life, bone regeneration is a quiet but powerful reminder of resilience. Every day, millions of microscopic breaks form in our skeleton, and every day, they are healed. It's a never-ending cycle of destruction and renewal that mirrors our emotional and spiritual lives. The same principle applies. Stress and impact, handled well, make us stronger. Avoiding stress entirely, physical or emotional, leads to a kind of decay. Growth comes from the right kind of pressure. So while supplements and science continue to explore the biochemical angles of bone regeneration, the most profound lesson may be a behavioral one. Move every day. Load your bones. Walk, climb, stretch, lift, push. Feel the impact of your feet on the ground because your bones are listening. They respond to every signal of life you send them, even late into old age. They want to grow. They're built to grow. But they require our participation, the literal weight of our will, to keep doing it. In the end, strong bones are not just the foundation of our physical structure, but the embodiment of our relationship with gravity, effort, and resilience itself. Reprinted with permission from Tom Hartman's Substack, The Wisdom School, What It Means to Be Human. Tom Hartman is a New York Times bestselling author, 34 books in 17 languages, and the nation's number one progressive radio host, as well as a psychotherapist and international relief worker. Sign up to receive the Hartman Report, a daily newsletter of Renaissance thinking about progressive politics, economics, science, and the issues of our day. Our final article today is also by Tom Hartman, the book that taught me to stop helping. Removing someone's difficulty for them is often not the gift it appears to be. Published May 11th, 2026. There are books you read and enjoy and set down, and there are books that break something open in you permanently. Rupert Ross's Dancing with a Ghost, published in 1992, is the second kind. I've read a lot of books in my life. This is one of a handful I'd say genuinely changed the way I move through the world. Ross was a Crown attorney, a Canadian prosecutor assigned to remote Indigenous communities in northwestern Ontario. He went in, as he freely admits, with the full set of Western assumptions about law, justice, healing, and the proper relationship between people. He came out a changed person. The book is his attempt to describe what happened to him and to understand the radically different worldview he encountered. And it is one of the most honest, generous acts of intellectual humility I've ever read from anyone working inside a government institution. What amazed me and what has stayed with me ever since was his account of the principle of non-interference. The principle of non-interference. In the communities where Ross worked, non-interference wasn't a passive thing, a reluctance to get involved, the way we sometimes use the word. It was a deeply held, actively practiced value, grounded in a fundamental respect for every person's right to walk their own path and make their own choices. You did not tell other people what to do. You did not offer unsolicited opinions about how someone else was living. You did not intervene in another person's journey because doing so would be a profound violation of their dignity and their sovereignty as a human being. Ross describes how this principle operated across every domain of life, from child-rearing to community decision-making to the response to personal crisis. The example that stopped my breathing was the story of a woman who had watched her son die by suicide without physically intervening. To Western eyes, including Ross's initial reaction, this was incomprehensible, even monstrous. Every instinct in the Western tradition, legal, medical, moral, and parental, says you intervene, you grab the rope, you call for help, you do something. The woman's stillness looked from outside like failure or indifference. We each have our journey that is ours to make. But Ross spent time sitting with the community's understanding of what had happened, and what he came to see was something far more complicated and in its own way far more serious than indifference. The woman had understood, within the framework her culture had given her, that her son was on a journey that was his to make. That her body stepping between him and his choice would have been, in the deepest sense available to her, a violation of who he was. Ross doesn't ask us to agree with this. He instead asks us to understand it well enough to stop assuming our framework is the only serious one. He writes about the encounter with that belief system as something that shook him to his core and never fully let him go. I've sat with that story for years. I'm not going to pretend I fully resolved the moral tension in it, and I'm not sure it can be fully resolved. There are situations where I believe intervention is the only human response, but the principle underneath that story, stripped of its most extreme application, is something I've come to believe is among the wisest things one culture has ever offered another. We do not have the right to impose our vision of the quote-unquote correct life on other people, not even on the people we love most. I've stopped giving unsolicited parental advice. Since reading Ross's book, I've tried to stop giving unsolicited advice to my children. That has not been easy. The parental instinct to correct, to guide, to share the lesson you learned the hard way so they won't have to, is almost physical in its urgency. When you love someone and you can see what you believe is a mistake forming in front of you, the impulse to step in feels like the most natural thing in the world. But Ross helped me see that what feels natural to me was constructed by my top-down culture, that my certainty about what would be good for another person is almost always, at least partly, a projection of my own preferences and fears. My children are adults. They have their own relationships with reality, built from experiences I wasn't present for and perspectives I don't share. When I offer advice they didn't ask for, what I'm communicating beneath whatever loving intention I bring to it is that I don't fully trust their judgment, that I think I can see their life more clearly than they can, that my discomfort with watching them navigate something hard is more important than their right to navigate it. People know things about their lives that you don't. Since reading Ross's book, I've extended this to everyone. If someone doesn't ask me what I think, I've been trying, with uneven but genuine effort, to not tell them. This is harder than it sounds in a culture that frames unsolicited advice as caring, as engagement, as proof that you're paying attention. We've turned the offering of opinions into a social currency. Withholding them can feel, to the person doing the withholding, like coldness or distance. But I think Ross would say that's our discomfort talking, not wisdom. What he found in those Northern Ontario communities was a social fabric built on a different kind of trust, a trust that people know things about their own lives that you cannot know from the outside, that growth often requires difficulty, and removing someone's difficulty for them is often not the gift it appears to be. That presence, real presence, being with someone without an agenda for them, is often the most profound form of love available. I think about the Japanese concept of ma, the meaningful pause, the space between things that gives them their shape. Ross's non-interference principle operates like that. The space you leave around another person isn't emptiness, it's respect made visible. Dancing with a Ghost is out of print and harder to find than it should be. If you can locate a copy, I'd encourage you to read it slowly and let it argue with your assumptions. Ross is a careful, humble writer, and he earns every conclusion he reaches. The book didn't just change how I think about Indigenous justice systems, which it did thoroughly. It changed how I think about what it means to love someone. Loving someone, I've since come to believe, means trusting them with their own life. Reprinted with permission from Tom Hartman's Substack, The Wisdom School, What It Means to Be Human. Mindful Moments is a production of Audio Journal, a proud member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network. If you would like a hard copy of our program schedule, either in large print or braille, please call 508-797-1117. Archived editions of this program are available on our website, audiojournal.org, or go to the Audio Journal app on your iPhone, iPad, or Android device. I'm Mary Lou Quinlan. Thank you for listening.
You are listening to Audio Journal, a proud member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network.
This is Bird Note. The golden-cheeked warbler is a star performer. Boldly dressed in yellow, black, and white, these little birds and their buzzy song take center stage in Texas hill country. The golden-cheeked warbler is an endangered species and the only bird that nests exclusively in central Texas. Males arrive in March to stake out a territory in the juniper oak woodlands. The older the trees, the better. While the female handles most of the nest construction and defense, both parents bring home the bugs to their hungry chicks. Look for them chasing insects on the wing or gleaning grubs from high in the canopy. By the end of July, the warblers are on their way back to mountain forests of southern Mexico and Central America. Golden-cheeked warblers can't survive without healthy, mature woodlands, but deforestation has destroyed and fragmented much of their habitat across the Americas. Now, this special songbird's future depends on people stepping up to protect our forests, from Nicaragua to Texas. For Bird Note, I'm Michael Stein. This episode is dedicated to naturalist Dave Sutherland from Boulder, Colorado, who has taught so many so much.
There are more than 1 million English words. Next up, word nerd Steph Donoff with some of them worth talking about.
If you ever doubt that English is out to get you, look at the word colonel. I'm talking about the military rank between a major and a general, spelled C-O-L-O-N-E-L. It is a word with two O's and two L's and no R whatsoever. But it is pronounced the same way we pronounce a kernel of corn. K-E-R-N-E-L, a word with only one L, one R, and not an O to be found. And I have looked. It started with the Italians back in the 16th century. They created a military rank called a colonello, spelled with three O's and three L's. The French decided to use the word for their own army and changed its spelling and pronunciation and made it coronel, spelled with two O's, one L, and one R. But then the English grabbed coronel and put its own unique spin on it. They replaced the R in coronel with an L, but kept the R sound and dropped the pronunciation of the second L and pronounced it colonel as in colonel. Why? Because that's what English does.
That's enough talk about words. Let's go back to listening to them.
Are you interested in taking the bus but aren't sure how? Let the Worcester Regional Transit Authority make it easier for you. The WRTA Travel Training Program is designed to help people who would like to use the regular WRTA fixed route bus service but aren't sure where to begin. You can receive instruction on a one-on-one basis, or you may bring a friend or relative and do it together. You decide. You will learn how to read a schedule, understand transit terminology, pay your fare, where to purchase tickets, what to do in case of an emergency, and all things having to do with learning to use public transit. If there is a particular route or routes that you would like to use, the travel trainer will tailor the training to meet your needs. Travel training is free of charge, and while you are with the travel trainer, your trips are free as well. Please call 508-453-3460 to set up an appointment today.